The song is Tomorrow Never Knows, the final track, the last track on the 1966 Beatles album Revolver, an album which not only changed rock and roll forever, but propelled the Beatles into something approaching a social force, and the reverberations we're still feeling. To those who are listening to the program live, we've just passed midnight Pacific time, and it's on this date, 50 years ago today, the Beatles performed their final regular concert. It was at Candlestick Park in San Francisco, ending the 1966 tour that was tumultuous, to put it mildly. Chuck Gunderson is a Beatles scholar, expert, historian, author, and researcher. He's uncovered how the FBI investigated the Beatles on a number of occasions and has compiled the story of the three U.S. tours, North American tours, into a book called Some Fun Tonight. It's a two-volume epic masterpiece. And in just a moment, Chuck will be here to tell us what went wrong in that 1966 tour and why it convinced the Beatles to not tour again. We'll be right back. Welcome back. In 1966, of course, the Beatles were the biggest act in the world, but they were about to get bigger. They embarked on a tour that concluded August 29th, 1966 at Candlestick Park in San Francisco, and then they didn't perform in public again, with the exception of that rooftop concert, the famous rooftop concert at top Apple Records, and that was it. So what happened in 1966? A whole bunch of stuff happened to them, a lot of it pretty unpleasant. And here to talk about that tour is Chuck Gunderson, who's written a massive compilation called Some Fun Tonight, and it is fun. It's a lot of work, a lot of scholarship went into it, but it's a great fun read. Chuck, good to have you back on the program.
Hi, George. Thanks again for inviting me. It's really great to be on the show again.
So set the stage. 1966, I guess end of 65 is when the previous album came out. They were riding high. They're experimenting musically. Set the stage for us.
Yeah, well, at the end, at tail end of 1965, of course, the Beatles released Rubber Soul, which was just a fantastic album, and of course, broke new barriers, and was highly acclaimed. And so going into 1966, it was pretty much business as usual. You know, Brian Epstein, their manager, was starting to put the pieces together of what would be the 1966 World Tour, like he did every year. He planned those. And actually, the Beatles had a little bit of time off, which they weren't used to in the early part. So things were really starting to swing into high gear about March of 1966, when Brian announced the World Tour. Really wasn't a world tour, so to speak, but it did include Germany and Japan. And they would do two concerts in the Philippines and then finally end up on North American soil to finish out the touring year. And interesting enough, that very next day, on after Brian announces the tour on March 3rd, on March 4th, the London Evening Standard prints the John Lennon article, which in the article he tells the interviewer Maureen Cleave that the Beatles were more popular than Jesus Christ. Of course, no one pays much attention to it in the UK, but it created a lot of attention when the tour was about to begin in the US in late July.
How did this tour, at least in North America, how did it compare to the 64 and 65 tours? More ambitious, less ambitious?
Well, the 64 tour was obviously the most ambitious tour. They had, after the Sullivan shows in February and the success of those shows, they came back in August that year, and they performed 32 shows in 33 days in 24 North American cities. Just crisscrossing the nation all over, raking in lots of money, sold out coliseums, arenas, wherever they played. 65, they come back. Basically, they can do no wrong at this point. They play an amazing historic show at Shea Stadium in New York, which basically ushers in the birth of the modern stadium concert for everything that would follow from that: Woodstock, Altamont, Watkins Glen, Live Aid. I mean, the Beatles birthed that. So, you know, with 66 coming, it was kind of the same as usual. They're going to go back on tour. Of course, a little less ambitious than in 1964. Instead of doing 32 shows in 33 days, they're going to do 19 shows in 18 days. So about half the time, but raking in, if not more, money.
I'm a fan, obviously. I play Beatles songs almost all the time that I host this program as bumper music, and I play it at home in my car. I still listen to it, so I am prone to hyperbole when it comes to this band. So maybe you, as the scholar, can summarize it, where they were in their career at this point, how big they were, and musically, what 1966 represented.
Well, I think 66 just changed the game completely for the Beatles. They had released a monumental album. U.S. fans got it in the first part of August, called Revolver. And it just completely changed how people listened to music. All of a sudden, the Beatles were now not constrained with trying to create music that they had to create live on stage, because I think in their minds, touring was just getting boring for them. Number one, the sound technology wasn't modernized to where they could recreate these songs on stage. And the Beatles were always about progressing. They never wanted to stay in the same state they were in. They didn't want to sing "I Want to Hold Your Hand" anymore. Instead, they wanted to create new things and more importantly, spend more time in the studio. Their first album in England, Please Please Me, was knocked out in one day.
Yeah.
And you know, now they're allowed more time in the studio to do these things. So Revolver just changed everything with studio innovations, you know, with tape loops, with backward recordings, with strings that were introduced, with Indian music, you know, a kid song like Yellow Submarine, and you know, psychedelic Tomorrow Never Knows, just everything that they could throw at it. And some of the engineers, you know, the Beatles would tell them, look, we don't want this piano to sound like a piano, or we don't want this guitar to sound like a guitar. You know, automatic double tracking was invented by the engineers at Abbey Road. And, you know, was soon adopted throughout the whole recording industry after that. And so Revolver just changed everything. And it allowed the Beatles to realize that, listen, we don't need to go on the road. We can just sit in the studio and create wonderful, amazing music. And we've seen it. I mean, you know, time endures it. We're still talking about it 50 years on.
Well, we'll talk about the tour itself, but back to what was happening in the studio. I mean, really, as you say, the music became so complicated they could not recreate that on stage. So it was an additional reason that, hey, we don't need to tour. We can't tour. We can't play these songs on stage and replicate what the sounds that we're making in the studio. Tomorrow Never Knows, that song that we played as a bumper into this segment, was the last song on the album, but maybe the first one they recorded. You read the stories about how complicated that was. It was a major undertaking.
Tomorrow Never Knows could not be recreated in the studio the way they engineered that. That was the first, obviously, track that they worked on. And I think there was probably a look of puzzlement on George Martin's face, the producer of those great albums at Abbey Road, and also manager Brian Epstein. I mean, when that kind of one note drone, you know, hit their ears, they just probably didn't know what to do, but they probably just thought, you know what? They're the Beatles. Let's just let them do what they do and see what happens. And of course, you know, Revolver is probably one of the most highly acclaimed albums they ever released. I think personally, I like it better even than Sgt. Pepper.
Let's get into the tour a little bit. So they start in Japan. I mean, you mentioned about John Lennon giving the interview, the quote about bigger than Jesus. It makes no ripple at all in the UK. It doesn't create any kind of controversy. Later, it comes back to haunt them when they hit the U.S. But before they get to the U.S., they go to Japan, and they've got trouble right off the bat.
Yeah, George, they actually started in West Germany, which was kind of a triumphant return from them. You know, they had cut their cloth there in Hamburg, playing those early club dates in the early 60s. So, you know, they had played a few cities in Germany. And even with the German press, They were getting tired of the same old press conference questions. You know, when is your fame going to end? You know, is your hair real? Those types of things. They weren't asking serious questions about the music. And the Beatles were kind of detesting those questions, and they were actually getting finally kind of snippy with reporters, and the reporters questioned them on that in Germany. So once they were through with that, they take a flight to Japan, and they're scheduled to play at the Budokan Arena. And the problem with the Budokan Arena is that no other rock and roll band had ever played there before, and it was actually a sacred martial arts arena. And so some of the older traditional Japanese people thought it was sacrilegious for them to defame the famous Budokan by playing rock and roll music there. So when the Beatles arrived, there were protests, there were signs that could be seen in the streets that said, "Beatles, go home." Now we take the Budokan for granted. We always hear, you know, every rock act that's a huge rock act has gone
cheap
to
trick.
The Budokan.
Yeah.
You know, Cheap Trick, live at the Budokan. I mean, who didn't have that album growing up? And so we just take it for granted that everyone played there. But when the Beatles first played there, they were the groundbreakers. They were the first to do it. And despite the protests, the concerts went on. So that was a real huge amount of controversy with that.
Then they go to the Philippines in July. And I guess they get into sort of a misunderstanding with the First Lady of the Philippines, and it causes some real serious trouble.
Yeah, so the tour trudges on over to the Philippines, and can you imagine, you know, playing in an outdoor arena, you know, stadium, you know, in July in the Philippines. But they had played two concerts there at the Rizal Stadium. And apparently the Marcos family, who had just come into power recently, thought that the Beatles would come and do a reception with them, you know, have a private meeting with them. And, of course, the word never got to the group that this was to occur. And they, all of a sudden, they, when they were about ready to check out of the hotel, you know, no one would help them with anything. And they couldn't figure out, they couldn't get their breakfast, they couldn't get their luggage toted down to the bottom of the stairs. And they finally turn on the news, and there's all this snafu about them not attending this reception that the Marcoses wanted them to be at. So they basically had to schlep their own way out of the Philippines, carrying their own luggage and equipment, and there was jostling at the airport. You know, some of the Filipinos were angry with them. They barely made it onto a British Airways plane, and I know when they got inside, they, you know, felt so good that there was one little piece of Britain, you know, that they could touch. But, you know, manager Brian Epstein was, before they took off, and a road manager, Mal Evans, was summoned to go meet with Filipino authorities. They probably turned over most of the money they made in the concerts. And probably had to do some other things. And finally, that plane was allowed to take off, and probably to the great relief of the Beatles and their entourage. So when they landed in London, finally, they had done an interview in the airport at Heathrow. And one of the reporters asked, "Well, what's next?" And George Harrison famously quipped, he goes, "Well, we're going to take a little break, and then we're going to go over and get beaten up by the Americans." So touring was just not one of their things that they really were looking forward to anymore.
All right, your book focuses on the U.S. tour, North American tour, 1966. Describe the scholarship that went into this amazing piece of work and the kinds of things that people see in it. Because unless you've got it in front of you, I don't think you can appreciate it.
Well, it was a very difficult work. It took me about 8 years of research to compile everything. And, you know, had the Beatles toured in the social media age, we would have pictures galore and stories galore. But when the Beatles came to town, even as late as 1966, there would only be maybe a paragraph or two in the paper that they came. There would be, you know, there wouldn't be anything about what they sang or many pictures. I mean, the photographers that were sent to these shows, you know, I'm sure they took a roll of film, but when they got back to the photo editing desk, you know, they picked one or two pictures and threw away the rest. So I really had to do a lot of interviews with the DJs that were there, with photographers, with the promoters, with the representatives from General Artists Corporation that partnered with Brian Epstein to Epstein to promote these shows with some of the people that worked for Brian, and of course the fans that attended. And so I had to get all their stories and make sure their stories were correct. Number one, that was the big part of just piecing the story of each city that they played in North America during those 3 years. The second thing was the photos. I mean, you would think there would be photos everywhere. There just wasn't. And as soon as I thought I found a cache of photos, they would go to the storage place wherever they were at, and they would open up the folder, and there would be a note inside and said the photos were stolen in 1972 or they were lost. So the photos were tough. And also, of course, the memorabilia was tough. The tickets that were produced, the handbills, posters, contracts, contract writers. And luckily, I found all of these things and was able to present them in the book.
Well, that's the coolest part is the memorabilia. The tickets, I mean, you have tickets. Are there any that you don't have of any of those shows from any of those tours?
Yeah, luckily, I've been a collector for a long time, George, and I've luckily found every unused ticket for every city except for three of them. So if any of your listeners are out there, if they have a Cleveland 1964 from Public Hall unused ticket, let me know. Or an unused ticket from the Montreal Forum afternoon show, I'd be interested in talking with you as well. And one show from Carnegie Hall. But all the other shows, I have an unused form, and it just took many, many years to try to find these.
Well, some of the stuff is amazing, and I don't know if you own all this stuff or you've just photographed it, but for example, there's a Pan Am brochure on page 159, signed by all four Beatles on their way to America on a Pan Am flight to kick off the 66 tour. I don't know if that was a flight attendant or who got that, but that's a pretty cool little thing to own.
Yeah, the Beatles, they signed a lot of things, but a lot of times the road managers signed for them. So it's very hard to authenticate real Beatles signatures. And there's probably, 80, 90% of them are probably fake out there because the road managers had stacks of photos that they would sign on the plane before they would get to a city and pass out to the police and the promoters because everybody wanted a piece of them. And so most of the stuff pictured in my book does come from my collection, that spans decades. And, and some very good friends of mine also supplied images, which I appreciated so much.
And amazingly, you look at these tickets and the prices, $6.50, I think, was the most expensive ticket.
Yeah, on the 1966 tour, the most expensive ticket was just under $8. The average price in 1966 was $4.85 to go see the Beatles.
So did they make money on that tour?
Oh, yeah, they made money on all three tours. During the 1964 tour, they made well over $1 million. It's interesting, after that 64 tour, the IRS tried to extract about $380,000 from them, claiming that they were a U.S. corporation. And it actually took their company, the Beatles company, several years to fight the IRS. And just like the Beatles do good at everything, they also do good at beating the IRS because they beat them. They got the money back with interest.
Amazingly enough, I mean, even though they were, immensely popular, biggest act in the world, actual attendance was way lower than what they would anticipated and way lower than the number of seats that were available, right?
Yeah, it's a bit of a misnomer, George, in a sense that, in 1964, their manager, Brian Epstein, was very astute and very smart in booking small venues. When they came over, promoters were lining them up to put them in huge venues in 1964. They were offered stadiums like Tiger Stadium, 50,000 seats. They were actually offered Shea Stadium as early as 1964, 60,000 seats. They were even offered the LA Coliseum at 80,000 seats. And Brian Epstein turned them all down, and he settled more for a conservative type venue like arenas, amphitheaters.
I'll tell you what, we're going to get into why he did that in just a moment. We're talking with Chuck Gunderson about Some Fun Tonight, his two-volume epic masterpiece about the 64 to 66 tours. We'll be right back. From Revolver, Eleanor Rigby, a long way from I Want to Hold Your Hand, a very serious, somber, introspective sort of a song, different kind of music, different from what else was going on in rock and roll. We're talking with Chuck Gunderson about his two-volume work, Some Fun Tonight, about the Beatle tours. 50 years ago tonight, the Beatles made their last concert appearance at Candlestick Park in San Francisco, and there are multiple reasons why they did not tour again. We're going to get into some of those and what happened at the cities along the way of that 66 tour that helped convince them that they didn't want any more of it. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. So, Chuck, talk to me about the choice of which cities they decided to tour, why they picked the ones they did, and the venues. Before the break, you were telling us that Brian Epstein had had choices for much larger venues, and he didn't pick the big ones in every case anyway. What went into that?
Yeah, so in 1964, he chose not to pick the larger venues in order to kind of pent up demand. And so he chose the smaller venues like Denver's Red Rock, Hollywood Bowl, Cincinnati Gardens Arenas, and things like that. So when 1965 rolls around, they're ready to play stadiums. Of course, they sell out Shea Stadium, which is the only stadium the Beatles ever sold out in North America in touring history. And a lot of people think the Beatles only played stadiums after that date, and that's just not correct. They still played amphitheaters, arenas, but the difference is if they played an arena or an amphitheater, Brian Epstein's going to do two shows in one day. So when 66 rolls around, you know, they're still attracting an amazing amount of people, and a lot of people think, well, the Beatles only played to half-empty stadiums. Well, to attract 30 or 40,000 people to a rock concert in the mid-60s was quite a feat. It just hadn't been done before. Not even Elvis was doing that. And, you know, we all got accustomed to stadiums selling out when the Eagles and Elton John in the 70s were, you know, selling out every seat in these huge stadiums. But this was rock rock music in its infancy with playing to stadiums. And the Beatles, again, were the innovators and the ones that started that.
So talk to me about where did they start? What's the first stop on the North American tour?
Yeah, so they started in Chicago at the old International Amphitheater. It's not there anymore. But that's the city where they had to come and do the famous press conference where John has to basically apologize for the statements that he made to Maureen Cleave back in March. And there was an American teenage magazine called Datebook that published the comments right before the tour kicked off in August, and it absolutely created a firestorm. As you know, the U.S. was much more religious compared to the U.K. being more secular, and a couple DJs got a hold of that and just ran with it. There was Beatle burnings and bonfires and protests everywhere, and so John in Chicago had to apologize for his statement. He's under a great amount of stress about the doing that, and the tour kicked off under that those auspices.
And can you document that it affected attendance or how significant a hit it took?
Well, Brian Epstein, when the Datebook article finally appeared in late July, Brian Epstein actually flew to New York to hold his own news conference just before, about a week before the tour kicked off, and to actually clarify the statements that John had made, to tell people that they were out of context. But another reason Brian flew into New York was to meet with the promoters of the shows, and he was prepared to take a huge hit and cancel the entire tour. As he met with the promoters, they decided, you know, let's keep it going. Let's do this. And Brian was such a good, honorable guy. He even lowered many of the guarantees in the cities that they played during the 1966 tour, because those promoters had been so good to him in supporting him in 1964 when the Beatles were just first coming to America. So that's kind of how it started. It was just on really shaky ground.
And pretty much everywhere they went, that they had a news conference, they had to face that question, right?
Yeah, and one of the big, huge changes that they did with the press conferences, in 1964, they did 25 formal press conferences in 33 days. They basically did one in every city. And a thing that they changed in 1966 is instead of a formal press conference, they did what was known as press tapings. And that is where they selected a few journalists to come into their dressing room, to come into their hotel, and to ask them questions instead of facing a whole barrage of questions from every journalist, from every type of media. This allowed them to kind of stay on their own turf, to answer questions that they really wanted to answer. And of course, the questions were turning a lot more serious, you know, about civil rights, about Vietnam, about politics. And the Beatles finally, they had always done it, even as early as 1964, but they were really stating what they believed in. And they stated, you know, their opposition to the Vietnam War. They stated their opposition to segregation and different things like that. And so that was a huge change for them to do in 1966.
And was the security scene the same as, you know, the hotels where they stay are besieged? I know you're right about in Chicago, there was some mystery about where exactly they stayed. Did they have to keep that secret or did the fans figure it out?
Yeah, that's still a question that's unanswered in the research that I did. We know that they stayed at the Astor Towers and down where they held the press conference and everything, but some of the people that I interviewed said they were actually spirited away to the Ascott Motel down on Michigan Avenue. It's still not substantiated yet. I'm still kind of sussing out that story. But my belief is they probably stayed at the Astor Towers the whole time. But yeah, every city they played in, they were still besieged. Brian Epstein this time and the contract writer asked for 50 more additional policemen. He'd asked for 100 in previous riders. So now he had 150 policemen. He also made a change in the rider that he wanted to have the Beatles protected not only to and from the airport, but to and from their hotel and to and from the venue. So security was a huge issue. They also finally introduced a backstage pass. They really didn't have any sort of thing in place in 1964. And finally in 1965, Brian's press officer, Tony Barrow, came up with the idea of issuing these identification passes to people that were part of the entourage. The support
and is that a first in rock music?
Yes. According to my research, that is the first time that some sort of identification pass was used. And in 1966, he even got more creative. Not only did he have a white backstage pass, which a lot of the entourage had, but he also had a red pass, which even now none of the Beatles carried a red pass, but Brian Epstein himself had to carry a red pass to get past the security. Was there as many fans coming to the airport to see them when they arrived? Not as much as 1964. The reason being is that usually the airplane would taxi way out into the lot of the airport that they flew into, and they would park next to a hangar, and the limousines would be waiting and just take them away immediately.
After Chicago, they're on to Detroit, two shows there. As you write in the book, they walked away with $100,000 for two, and these are 30-minute shows, right?
Yeah, they had an 11-song set during the 1966 tour, but you did have to sit through about an hour and a half support act consisting of the Remains and Bobby Head, the Circle, and the Ronettes, and then finally the Beatles would come out. They'd be on for about 30 minutes, and it's interesting you mentioned that Detroit show. And this, again, this is, you know, our touring was just so archaic back then. The Beatles performed at Olympia Stadium. It was an indoor theater there in Detroit. And they got on a bus after the show, still in their stage clothes. They actually changed in the back of the bus. And they then traveled through the night to their next stop in Cleveland. And had you followed the bus from them, from the Detroit show, the bus actually stopped at a Howard Johnson's on the Ohio Turnpike in the middle of the night so the Beatles could stretch their legs, get some ice cream, and continue the journey to Cleveland.
Cleveland was pretty tumultuous, as I recall. There were problems with the mayor, didn't he? I think it was after the concert appearances, but he banned rock and roll from Cleveland, or at least from some venue there?
Yeah, 1964, Mayor Ralph Locher, after the Beatles performed there in September of 64, and that was followed by a Rolling Stones concert in November. And because the crowd just got completely out of control, he banned rock and roll concerts from public hall. And when the Beatles returned in 1966, the ban was still in place at public hall. But of course, if they played public hall again, they would have had to do two shows since public hall only seated 10,000. So the next biggest venue in Cleveland was Municipal Stadium. And at the time, Municipal Stadium could hold 83,000 people. Well, not that many people showed up. There was about 25, 30,000 people there. But about three or four songs into the set, there was just this mass wave of people leaving their seats. Now, remember, there was no field seating. If they played a stadium, the stage would be parked there at second base. But they left their seats, and about 2,000 or 3,000 people rushed toward the stage. The Beatles actually had to run for their lives. There was a trailer parked behind stage that kind of housed their dressing room. And the police had to restore order, get the fans back into their seats. Pretty much everyone thought the concert was over, but John Lennon told Tony Barrow, who was Brian Epstein's press officer, no, we're going to go out and finish the show. And so they triumphantly went back on stage and kicked off with rock and roll music again, the opening number of their set. So Clevelanders got to hear that song twice, and they finished the show. But it was a extremely wild event.
I guess at a couple of cities, you said that they skipped the news conferences, but they did do one in Washington. And, of course, you figure the Washington press corps would be about as tough as it gets. Maybe New York would be the only thing comparable. But how did that go?
The press conference at the D.C. Stadium wasn't too bad. There was a lot of softball questions, a few good ones. But that was actually the first city where the Ku Klux Klan came out and started protesting the show due to John Lennon's statement. So that was the first time. It was, you know, one of the more northern cities where the Beatles saw. A lot of people think, oh, well, the Klan really didn't protest till they got into the South. And they really only played one venue in the South during that year. But D.C. was the first place they saw the hooded Klansmen.
I remember in the you have a section in the book where you wrote about a reporter asking about Eleanor Rigby, whether or not there's Father McKenzie, that whole bit about his sermon, whether that was also some kind of a put down of Christianity.
Yeah, they were trying to trick them up on questions that would ultimately go back to John's statement on Christianity. And of course, John was hearing this question throughout the tour and apologizing. But, you know, it's interesting because at the start of the tour, and if you watch the press conference video, which there is on YouTube of the Chicago press conference, John is extremely nervous, chewing his gum fast, just a little bit flustered. But by the time he gets to Memphis, which is just a little bit over a week later, you see a much more confident John Lennon defending his statements and not really caring what the press is throwing at him or what fans or those that thought his statement was wrong, what he thought about them. And I thought that showed a lot of maturity on John's part.
We'll divert from the tour for a second. Brian Epstein died not long after this tour ended. And I don't know if that, you know, he organized so much, did so much for the band. I mean, maybe that was part of why they didn't go back on the road.
Well, it's interesting to look at that, George. And Brian Epstein basically died almost a year in the day to the final bow at Candlestick Park. And of course, Brian was instrumental. I mean, we found them in the cavern in Liverpool playing. And one of the big parts of his management contract was getting them gigs, getting them concerts to play. And he did fantastic at it. But it was kind of since 1964, it was kind of in the making that the Beatles would stop touring. In 1964 alone, Brian had them play 215 concerts. I don't know how they did that along with recording music. They did Hard Day's Night movie that year. They were doing television appearances, you know, writing music. I mean, how they ever did that, I'll never know. And in 1965, he only had them playing 78 concerts. And then finally, in 66, he only had them play 33 concerts. And yeah, that was a lot of Brian's job to do that. So it is interesting that, you know, and as the Beatles moved more and more into the studio and not so much doing public appearances, that Brian died just a year later. It was a very sad day.
You know, he was so instrumental in their success and such a key part of their story. And, you know, they cared about him so much. But the fact is, he really screwed up a lot of deals, the merchandise deals. I think I remember talking to you about it when they, the beginning of the 64 tour, when they came in, he had signed away the rights to ridiculous deal where he basically gave it away.
Yeah, Brian doesn't get credit for a lot of things, but, you know, we have to look at, and I'm a real big fan of Brian.
Yeah.
Brian was just the chief architect of making this whole thing happen. Here he saw these guys in the cavern who were smoking on stage, swearing on stage, you know, not dressed properly, just very unprofessional. And Brian, you know, cleaned up their act and put suits on them and, you know, saw that their talent and, you know, and said that they could be bigger than Elvis one day. And Brian himself, you know, is part of the story. I mean, here's Brian who comes from a poor town in Liverpool, who's a Jewish man who's gay. I mean, the story just couldn't get any better. And, you know, so Brian's kind of inventing all of this as he goes along. I mean, no rock act had ever done any of this before. They weren't playing 25,000 seat stadium, you know, 50,000 seat stadiums and 20,000 seat arenas. And, you know, merchandising just wasn't around. You know, we take it for granted today when we go to concerts, we can buy T-shirts and CDs and everything. When you went and saw a Beatles concert during those years in America from 64 to 66, the only thing licensed that you could buy was a program for $1. That was it. There was just no blueprint for this, and Brian created it for all the future bands that followed the Beatles to enjoy.
Well, there was nothing like that band when they hit the U.S. and the explosion of merchandise, the Beatle wigs, and you're on lunchboxes, and they were on everything. And I'm not criticizing him or putting him down for it, but clearly he this was unexplored territory.
Yeah, and that was one deal that he just did not do well. And a man by the name of Nicky Byrne approached him and said, look, I want to handle all the merchandising for the band. And like you mentioned, George, there was lunch boxes and wigs and nylon stockings and thermoses and, you know, baby powder, all that. And he said, I'll give you a 90-10 deal. And I'm thinking Brian thought that he was getting the 90%, but in turn, it was Nicky Byrne who got it. And so, yeah, they lost a lot of money with the merchandising. My understanding is that they licensed more products second only to Mickey Mouse.
And how long did that stuff last? Did he fix it by the time they were back around in 66, or was that a long-term deal?
No, he didn't fix it. And as the band progressed more and more into the studio in late 66 and into 67, you know, the merchandising was really getting limited. You know, people weren't going out and buying Beatle wigs anymore, things like that. And what you could buy was pretty limited at that point.
I mean, they became more sophisticated. Their fans became more sophisticated. We're gonna take a break here and come back and continue talking about the tour with Chuck Gunderson and about his book, Some Fun Tonight, the backstage story of how the Beatles rocked America, the historic tours of 64 through 66. Stick around.